Gentlemen, good evening to you. It is gratifying to see so many of you here at this, the 13th meeting of our small association, the Club for Curious Scientific Men, better known to all of us as the CCSM. Now, it is perhaps the source of some surprise that I, as a founder member, have yet to address our circle personally. In part, this is, well, down to modesty. Since we have in our time heard a goodly number of illuminating speeches by more celebrated men, from the startling reports of Professor G. Challenger to that mathematical genius who spoke to us upon the dynamics of an asteroid, to the, well, I thought, rather troubling investigation outlined by Mr. Griffin. It is my intention tonight, however, to adumbrate to you a sequence of incidents which lately has befallen me. My account will take you from the cool mystery of the Aegean Sea to a hellish dimension, ruled over by inhuman creatures. I know. I understand your expressions of skepticism and incredulity. Nonetheless, the narrative that I intend to present is not only entirely true, but also of no little personal significance, as it shall, I hope, show how I was lifted from a state of melancholia to be given new energy and verve. I will be most grateful for your patience and indulgence as I read to you this new paper of mine, which, after due consideration, I have entitled Some Observations Pertaining to a Succession of Events which took place both upon the island of Minos and within a nameless dimension.
Dear, oh dear, oh dear. That's just not right at all.
Henry, what the deuce do you think you're doing? Correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm fairly certain you're not a member of the CCSM.
No, but I met a fellow who was. Won his ticket off him in a game of shove halfpenny.
You said what?
Said his name was Barrington Scott the Third. Lily-livered innocent abroad. Couldn't hold his liquor.
Well, that's as maybe. What do you think you're doing here? Not that it isn't always a pleasure to see you. But I am, as it happens, in the midst of speaking upon a subject of some importance.
Oh, I know, Professor. But this just isn't how one tells a story. Not if you want to keep your audience in the palm of your hand, impatient for each new terrifying twist and rambunctious revelation.
But I'm not telling a story. I'm presenting an academic paper to a room full of clever men whose patience we are already beginning to place under strain.
But all audiences are the same in the end, from the brainiest university chaps to a fellow like me, with a diploma from the School of Life and a doctorate from the Academy of Hard Knocks. They all want spectacle. They all want charm. They all want a hint of the forbidden and a soupçon of the naughty, a glimpse of well-turned ankle, the suggestion of a shapely thigh.
Thank you so much for your suggestions. Now, if it's all the same to you, I should prefer to continue.
Oh, my dear fellow, you shall. You must. But you ought to do so with me at your side.
You're not serious.
Never have I been in deadlier earnest. After all, I was there for a portion of what you're about to describe, and the rest I experienced in parallel. Between the two of us, we can piece the thing together. Present these gentlefolk with the complete picture.
Well, I suppose there are some elements in which I was not personally present, and concerning which your testimony might be of interest and use.
Capital, my dear fellow, first rate. Knew you'd see the light in the end.
But I still wish to read my paper in its entirety. I will ask you to speak only when it is chronologically appropriate.
Of course. I'm here strictly to provide corroboration. I'm merely additional colour.
Well, if you're sure. And in that case...
I can stay?
Yes, you can stay.
Splendid. Now then, I think we should start by throwing out your title.
Throwing it out?
Yes, far too dreary, George. Dry as a bone. How about this instead?
You brought your own pen, I see.
Oh, only in the unlikely possibility that I would have to make a very few minor annotations to your no doubt admirably accomplished account.
I see. And that's your proposed title?
It is, yes, that's right.
Henry, I am not delivering a paper called The Triumph of H.G. Jago, a melodrama in two acts.
No?
Although I agree that my own heading was perhaps unduly scholarly. Given that these events delivered us from a period of something very like dejection, how about this?
Yeah, I like it, George. It's got muscle. It has voluminous vim.
In which case, I propose that we proceed. Gentlemen, my apologies for these unscheduled changes. I hope you'll agree that our evening will now possess a rather more flavoursome quality than might otherwise have been the case. I am delighted, then, to be able to present you with a full account of those recent and remarkable events, which is now entitled... Henry?
Yes. Which is now entitled...
The Jago and Lightfoot Revival!
Big Finish present Doctor Who. Short Trips. The Jago and Lightfoot Revival. Act 1 by Jonathan Bowles. Read by Trevor Baxter and Christopher Benjamin. You ought to know from the start that our lives, those of my friend Henry Gordon Jago and I, have become very far from ordinary. We seem at times to act as magnets for the strange, the bizarre, and the inexplicable. Before we met, however, our existences were altogether unremarkable. Henry had his work at the theatre, and I had mine in the lab. Yet after our first encounter, our days became filled up with the uncanny. In the future, I shall perhaps share with you some of these outre experiences, but for tonight, all you need to understand is that matters since the new year had been unusually quiet. We had met occasionally for supper, but our days were uninterrupted by anything at all unusual. Such a state of affairs was not merely tedious, but also dispiriting. I began to feel the pull of my ears, as well as a sense of, as the poet put it, that I have of late, but wherefore I know not, lost all my mirth.
It's true. You seemed distinctly down in the dumps, and I wasn't much better myself. Without our usual startling scrapes and astonishing adventures, it all seemed terribly dull. Even the acts at the new Regency seemed a bit on the stale side. Why, the roar of the crowd barely seemed to touch me. It was as though we were sleepwalking, a couple of sorrowful somnambulists stepping sluggishly through our days. And whereas George took solace in matters poetical and philosophical, I found my sanctuary at the bottom of a pint glass in that estimable and evergreen establishment, the Red Tavern, which I recommend unreservedly to you all. Oh, yes, simply say that Jago sent you, and you'll receive a warm welcome at the bar. Well, a welcome and perhaps an outstanding tariff or two. And if you'll be so kind as to provide the wherewithal in that embarrassing eventuality, I should count it as a signal honour.
But to return to the narrative itself, Henry.
Of course, yes, we must cleave to the issue at hand.
This altogether disagreeable season of inaction finally started to come to an end with the arrival at my quarters of a letter from Miss Jean Bazemore.
Jean, of course, being a former girlfriend of old George here. I remember him getting this enigmatic epistle and being absolutely cock-a-hoop about it. Hanged if I could see why. The arrival of a letter from any old flame of mine would trigger not the slightest bit of joy, but rather a desire to closely guard my pocketbook, allied with considerable vexation in the region of Mitika.
For the record, I should like to state that Jean was never anything even slightly like a girlfriend, but only a good and loyal pal.
Well, that's your story and you're sticking to it, eh? Very wise, sir. Jolly canny.
Anyway, the letter arrived from Jean stating that in the course of her work as an archaeologist, she was at present stationed upon the Greek island of Minos. There was a dig in that place which was uncovering all sorts of fascinating artefacts, which had to do with the earliest stages of human civilization. And Jean asked, almost as if she sensed that my life had fallen into a rut, whether I would care to join her for a month or so, believing that the tranquillity of the island be a welcome tonic, and that a close observation of their findings would be to me of no small intellectual interest.
Not exactly my idea of a holiday. Give me a British seafront any day. That and the honest smell of frying fish, and perhaps a show or two on the pier.
I agreed enthusiastically, sending a reply by the same day's post. Things were quiet then. Indeed, in my mortuary they were as quiet as the grave, and it proved no difficulty for me to take a small, and I should go so far as to say well-earned, sabbatical. All necessary arrangements were made at considerable speed, and only a little more than a week had passed before I found myself, one modest suitcase in hand, boarding the RMS Indomitable at Dover. My friends came to see me off, Henry Hare and our loyal associate, Miss Ellie Higson.
Ah, how well I recall that mournful afternoon. Waving you away, Professor, as that mighty vessel moved from English waters with all the dignified ponderousness of our Queen herself, and struck out for the international unknown. Poor Ellie was quite distraught as you sailed from us with such definitive determination, and I confess to feeling something of a tremor in my innards myself.
I never knew you cared so deeply.
Well, I'd had a distinctly gamey eel pie by way of a belated breakfast, and it was raising the very dickens in my belly. As soon as your ship had given itself up to the horizon, young Ellie and I chose to calm ourselves in a nearby establishment devoted to all matters libationary. And while we were wetting our whistles, the lady and I discoursed upon those titanic twin topics of torpor and loneliness.
Sounds like you had quite a heartfelt discussion.
Well, I suppose we did. Considerable ground was covered. And you know what they say, in vino veritas and all that? Funnily enough, we found ourselves talking about the business of luck, good fortune. We concluded that we both enjoyed rather a lot of it, all things considered. And we even found ourselves wondering, given the untold tedium of the year so far, whether we hadn't just run out of the stuff. We were as downcast a duo as you can imagine. It was a sore-headed Jago and Higson who made their way back to the metropolis. Whilst I dare say you were having the time of your life on the Indomitable.
Not a bit of it, my dear fellow. On the contrary, I was bored.
But the last time we went to sea, we were beset by all manner of complex coincidences and eerie encounters.
I know. But I think the most important word in what you've just said, Henry, is we.
We?
When we're together, the chances of our being confronted by strange events seem to be greatly increased. When we're apart, the likelihood of such incidents are, in my opinion, considerably reduced. So my voyage was spent merely in reading and strolling about the deck and considering the possibility of writing my memoirs. Pleasant enough for a day or two, but after that really rather dull. Things grew scarcely more arresting when I landed in Minos. It was beautiful, of course. Verdant, green and hot. And it was, as ever, a pleasure to see Miss Bazemore. We stayed in the same modest but agreeable hotel and spent several pleasant evenings in reacquaintance and in the discussion of any number of mutual academic interests.
Sounds riveting. A veritable banquet of delights.
It was peaceful, but uneventful. The dig itself was intriguing enough, but a day or two spent amongst trenches examining brooches and shards of pottery was quite sufficient to sate my curiosity. By the end of my first week, I'd grown somewhat restive. And so it was that I took to wandering alone about the island, exploring its peaks and shallow valleys, ambling through its shaded walkways, but inevitably gravitating towards the cool blue of the Aegean Sea. And it was upon the eighth day that I first glimpsed him, the tall, dark-haired man. He cannot have been any more than 40 years of age. He was dressed in a most peculiar sort of suit, and wore a long brown coat. He seemed oddly out of place in that idyllic spot, as if he'd been cut out of a picture book and glued down upon this tropical vista. I saw him first in the morning, watching from a distance. Although I did not recognize him, something in me seemed to say that I knew him all the same. I had to stop myself from raising a hand in greeting. Jean appeared at my side to ask whether I meant to return to the dig that afternoon. I said that I thought I should spend the day in my own company. And when I looked again, the man in the brown coat had vanished. Again, at luncheon, as I sat at the little taverna by the beach, I saw the stranger walking by the ocean's edge in stark outline against sea and sky. I watched as he walked with evident purpose in my direction. But then my attention was distracted once more, and when I looked up, he had disappeared, an act as which, as far as I could make out, was altogether impossible. It was not until the evening when I saw him again, and for the final time, when I realized at last who he must be.
I like it, Professor. Something in the way of a cliffhanger. Keep us guessing. Keep us straining for the truth before reeling us in like the wily old angler you are.
I thought it might be an apposite moment in which to halt my account so that you could interject with your own. So how had you spent the weeks of my voyage and subsequent sojourn upon Minos?
Aha, good question. Glad you asked it. Well, things had stayed pretty much in the doldrums ever since we'd seen you off. Life had something of the colour leached out of it. Even the theatre, which has, since my earliest days, been a wellspring of constant delight, seemed thin and predictable. On top of that, it was almost as if my own mood was affecting the new regency herself. The place was growing rather threadbare, and gradually, over the course of your absence, it became apparent that I had something of an infestation problem on my hands. Cobwebs everywhere. Great thick swathes of the stuff. Jolly unpleasant, I can tell you, and getting worse by the day. As soon as we cleared it up, it was back again, and twice as bad, in time for the matinee. I remember taking refuge in the snug at the Red Tavern, where Ellie said this to me. "Mr. Jago, sir," she says, "these eight-legged blighters will be the death of you. You can't do it alone. You'll have to get somebody in to help you." But I'm a proud man, always have been. Hold myself up with my bootstraps, and happy to have done it. I've never been good at accepting assistance from others, even from one as dutiful, diligent, and decorative as Miss Higson. Yet several jars later, she'd won me round with the force and vigour of her argument. "And here's a coincidence, Mr. J," says she. "There was a young man in here earlier today, very charming. He said he was a sort of exterminator by trade, an expert, he said, in eradicating pestilent beasties of all kinds. And here," she held up with a flourish, something square and cream-coloured and expensive, "here's his card."
So, what did you do next?
As soon as I'd exited the tavern, you mean, blessed with that additional degree of perception that's traditionally granted by the mighty nectar of the bar?
Yes, after that.
I accepted Ellie's advice, employed a passing young ragamuffin to take a message to this exterminating Johnny to come down to the Regency post-haste and bring with him his most efficacious armoury to combat the arachnid threat.
What was his name, this professional killer?
I just told you. Exterminating Johnny.
Ah, and did this Johnny come to the theatre?
He did, the very next day. The evening's takings had been decidedly disappointing, and I'd begun to fear that word was spreading as to the webs which were draped across the very fabric of the place. So I was jolly grateful when he arrived. Not that his timing was specially convenient.
No.
In a bid to enliven the lineup of the bill, I'd advertised for new acts to audition. Naturally, given the unsurpassed prestige of the Regency, I'd expected to find a queue snaking out of the box office and onto the street. In this I was disappointed. I'm not sure, you know, that the golden age of the music hall isn't already over. The titans that bestrode the stage when I first came into the business, the legendary maestros and musicians and practitioners of the arts of prestidigitation, all gone now. And those that replace them don't seem to me to have anything like the same aura of quality and distinction. Still, we must work with the materials we have to hand. And so it was I interviewed that morning a young lady from Walthamstow, who claimed to be able to disappear at will, without so far as I could see the slightest shred of success. A group of itinerants from Liverpool, who made the most terrific racket on four badly tuned banjos, and a young man who, in spite of a rather engaging manner and some interesting notions in the millinery line, was perhaps the most singularly inept juggler whom I've ever had the misfortune to have witnessed. It was in the midst of this parade of incompetence and mild delusion that young Johnny arrived, laden down with cases of equipment, devices of every kind, and all the scientific paraphernalia of his breed. But to give the poor young mastermind his due, he saw at once that I was deeply engaged in the duties and responsibilities of my office. He simply waved and called out that he would begin his investigation solo. He said he thought the root of the problem lay in the basement, and so off to that dank and rarely visited spot he dashed, his arms full of his astonishing accoutrements. He seemed quite in his element, so I was very happy to leave him to his labours. But then, in the midst of the juggler's doomed attempt to persuade me that he was a performer of merit and skill, we all of us heard it. The unmistakable sound.
And what was that?
The blood-chilling noise, Professor, of a man's scream. The ghoulish, ghastly, grisly death cry of a fellow human being.
Meanwhile, on Minos...
Oh, smartly done, George. A decidedly dexterous demonstration of deft dramatic skill.
Meanwhile, on Minos, leaving Jean in conversation with her colleagues, I had gone at twilight for a stroll, and I soon found myself down by the edge of the ocean. I looked out to sea, and I saw no ships of any kind, but only a deep, untarnished azure stretching beyond the horizon. I took in deep breaths of that clean, clear air, and I thought for a while of the past and of what the future might hold. And for a time, everything was still and calm, as if the moment might never end. But then I noticed something by my feet. In the sand. It gleamed in the fading light of the evening, and as I leant down to take a closer look, I saw that it was a battered, rusting mouth organ.
Yorks! Not the sort of thing one expects to find by the seashore.
Indeed not. And it soon became clear to me that this was no ordinary harmonica. Rather, it had a beguiling quality, a kind of magnetism. Without hesitation, indeed, almost without thinking, I picked it up. It seemed to crackle in my hand, as if it were, in some impossible way, alive. And then, in what must number high amongst the most deliriously uncharacteristic acts of my life, I placed the thing to my lips and began to play.
You, George?
Me. I'd never played the blessed instrument before, or even anything remotely like it. But somehow it came quite naturally. Without understanding how such a thing were possible, I found myself playing a weird, raucous, high-pitched melody, which seemed to combine in its strange tune something both of plain song prayer and saloon bar ditty. It had, I came to realize, a quality of invocation. I tried to stop, but realized I could not do so. I was all but possessed by the instrument. I played and played until my lips were sore and my breathing was ragged. At last, I grew too tired to go on, at which the harmonica allowed me to stop for a few seconds. Suddenly feeling free, I hurled the thing as far as I was able, far, far into the Aegean. And then I saw them. Out at sea. But walking across the water, seeming almost to float towards me, one of the oddest sights I've ever beheld. Six men, all dressed in the manner of cowboys, sauntering silently across the waves with a kind of cool implacability. They had about them a distinct, palpable malevolence. Half a dozen dark, what I suppose you would call, gunslingers, headed at speed towards the shore. I felt quite certain, without having the least evidence for my assumption, that I'd called them up somehow, and that they'd answered my inadvertent summons. At the instant I had this thought, I realized that he was by my side. The man in the long brown coat. He looked at me, and then at the approaching figures. "Now that's something you don't see every day," he said. His accent was a kind of cultured Cockney, flecked with hints of Scots. "You know what you've gone and done, George? You've only gone and called up the gentleman of the dice. Remorselessness incarnate. Rapaciousness personified. You know the sort of thing." "Have we met?" I asked. "Oh, yeah, of course, loads of times. Though I've changed since then, more than once. You're..." "Yes, George?" At that moment, I found myself remembering a man who I met before on several of the most remarkable occasions of my life. A man who stands forever at the centre of chaos. A man who arrives when you least expect him, and who brings danger and adventure in his wake. A man who fixes things. A man who heals. And above all, a man who can show each and every one of us how to become the very best version of ourselves. And so I smiled and I said, "You're the doctor, aren't you?" At this he gave a big, broad, and almost rather foolish grin. "Spot on," he nodded, like a cheeky schoolboy, towards the gunslingers who were now practically upon the sand. "Let's catch up later, eh? For now I want to suggest the better part of valour. So we run, Doctor. Take my hand, George. And on Z!"
Just as George was running in the company of that extraordinary fella, I was moving the old legs in a similar direction. Upon hearing that dreadful scream of agony, I did my duty and made a dash for it. Not towards the sound, of course, but rather with the intention of heading out onto the street and flagging down one of those excellent constables, upon whose brawny resilience our great city depends. But this was not how things turned out. The juggler, of all people, leapt off the stage and headed towards the doors, using a hand to keep on his fez. "Now that," he said, sounding all 11 years old, "didn't sound healthy at all. I think we'd better investigate, don't you?"
No, I said, "no, I think it'd be wisest under the circumstances for us to leave that entirely in the more than capable hands of the professionals."
"But you're Henry Gordon Drago. You are the professionals. Come on."
Turning, he dashed away in the direction of that blessed basement and called back over his shoulder almost giddily, "Come on, Henry." So I'd little choice but to follow, reluctantly and at a distance. Eventually we reached our destination, and my very worst fear was realised. The place was thick with glutinous web, and lying upon the floor, his neck at a hideous angle, was the broken body of poor Johnny. He who had pledged to rid the theatre of the infestation, but who now, sadly, had succeeded only in leaving the minority. At the edges of the room was a still worse sight. A fantastically shaped creature, hirsute and many-legged. Something between a spider, a beetle, and a centipede, and around the size of a pit pony.
"Oh, but that's beautiful, don't you think?"
The juggler turned to face me. "Don't you think that's a beautiful sight, Henry? I mean,
yeah, deadly and horrible, but kind of wonderful all the same. Nature, eh?"
"I think it's an abomination," I said. "And I'll wager a pound to a peahen that it's not from the planet Earth."
"Oh, well, yeah, your money be safe with that one," the juggler said, to which I replied, with, I think, a forgivable hint of triumph in my voice, "Thank you, Doctor."
The young fellow beamed as if flattered. He recognised me. As the bishop once said to the actress, "It took me a little while, but I got there in the end."
colour me impressed, he said. I'd love to talk some more, but for now, yes, we're trapped in a basement with a merciless killer, and, well, I don't want to alarm you, Henry, but it's starting to look like we're next on the menu. And as if on cue, the creature, that horrible, hairy, villainous beast, reared up out of the shadows and flung itself with murder in its deep red eyes at me, Henry Gordon Jago, and the Doctor.
Thank you, Henry. I think we'll leave it there for now. Gentlemen, refreshments have been provided. Do enjoy the interval. Help yourself to fruitcake and port, and we shall all reconvene shortly.